You're listening to the Party in My Plants podcast, and you're about to hear how not giving a F-U-C-K about stuff can actually give you everything you F-U-C-K-I-N-G want. I'm not just feeling sassy today. I'm actually referencing an actual best-selling book title and a viral life-changing TED Talk topic here. Jeez. Welcome to the Party in My Plants podcast, where I make healthy living as fun as a party so you'll, you know, actually want to do it and then actually feel, look, and live your best. I'm your host, Talia Pollock. Now let's get this party started. This episode is enthusiastically sponsored by a product I couldn't swear by more if I tried. Four Sigmatic Mushrooms. I didn't say swear about more. I said swear by. I couldn't swear by the magic of mushrooms more if I tried. I originally tried a packet of Four Sigmatic Mushroom tea in a glass of hot water because, well, I was gifted a free single packet of Four Sigmatic Mushroom tea by a friend. I had no idea what it did or what was going to happen to me. And I was skeptical because this whole mushroom thing is trendy right now. And I'm always skeptical of trendy things. Read, I avoid trendy things to not be trendy. You know what I mean? But anyway, I drank the shrooms and I felt truly awesome. It's hard to explain. I just felt more awesome than before I drank it. Since then, I've ordered it and consumed about 2 packets of shrooms a day, and I can't get enough. I am telling you, these mushrooms are magic. Although they don't make me hallucinate in a bathtub like my ex-boyfriend's famous magic mushroom experience, which honestly, he seemed way too proud of in hindsight. But hear this, I wasn't hallucinating the magical effects of these shrooms. They are ultra scientifically proven to boost immunity and gut health. Yes, please, and thank you. And the 4 different shrooms that Four Sigmatic uses most, hence the 4 in Four Sigmatic, I just got that too. Well, like 3 minutes ago. But they all do different epic things for your bod. Reishi helps you relax. Cordyceps give you non-caffeinated energy for sports and stuff. Lion's mane, which does not come from a lion's mane, boosts your brain. That one's easy to remember. And chaga is good for immunity issues like when you're traveling or feeling run down and or both. Okay, enough blabbering from me. I just finished a mushroom matcha latte. Oh yeah, Four Sigmatic has mushroom matcha powder. If I could just stop blabbering for a damn second, I could tell you that because you listen to this podcast, thank you for that, you can save 15% off any and all Four Sigmatic shroom stuff you'll want to buy off their site, Four Sigmatic, FourSigmatic.com, using code PARTYINMYPLANTS to save that 15%, baby. Man, maybe I had way too much mushroom matcha. Okay, onward to the show. Beep, beep. This is a warning by a person pretending to be a robot voice recording that this episode contains many expletives. So if you have young children in the room, which is redundant because all children are young, but if you've got kiddos in earshot, you might want to get them out of earshot or put headphones in your ears or, hey, teach them some adult words. I'm not judging. My guest today is many impressive things. She's a wife. Well, is that impressive? I'll go with it. She's a 3 times internationally best-selling author. I'd say that's as impressive as it gets. Her books have been translated into 18 languages. I probably couldn't even list 18 languages. She's a TEDx speaker, and her talk has been viewed over 3 million times. And she's one of the funniest writers I've ever read. Is that proper grammar? Ugh, screw it. It's hopefully pretty obvious why I consider her to be like my idol. Sarah Knight, whose first book, The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving an F. Okay, I should just say the word because we do say it a ton in this chat, okay? Her book is The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck, not to be confused with The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. Very different author. very different book. Although actually more similar than you might think, which we talk a ton about. But anyway, Sarah's first book blew her onto the scene and up the charts and rocked a lot of people's lives. And since then, she's quickly banged out two follow-up books, Get Your Shit Together and You Do You, both of which continue to rock a lot of peeps' lives. So without me bragging about the other peeps' lives who she's rocked, now let me help her rock yours. I am just ecstatic to be able to talk to you today, Sarah. You are one of my literary heroes. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes. So you've been called and have embraced the title of the anti-guru. I'm wondering, what does that mean and why do you go by that?
Well, it was something that kind of came out from a British magazine called The Observer, and it really struck a chord with my publicists, my publishers, and myself. And I thought, you know what? That's exactly what I am, because I'm not this kind of person who wants to preach a lot of advice and sort of force people to follow it through kind of shaming tactics. It's very much like what you see is what you get. And if you want to take my advice and your life is better for it, so be it.
That's interesting. That's awesome. So, I mean, how did this whole self-help book trilogy start for you? I mean, what, like 2.5 years ago, you were just living here in Brooklyn. I'm in Brooklyn, but you were working as a senior editor at a major New York City publishing house. And now you're a badass 3 times best-selling self-help author living in the Dominican Republic.
When you say it like that, it really does seem kind of implausible. But yes, that's exactly what happened.
Oh my God.
I was working in book publishing for 15 years. I was a senior editor and I was very successful at it. And I liked my job for a long time and I loved collaborating with writers, but I started to become just really depressed about the corporate environment and just really felt like I couldn't sort of be myself and have the life I wanted if I stuck with that sort of 9-to-5 lifestyle. And so I made the really tough decision to quit that job. And then I spent a year saving up money and kind of bolstering my, you know, psyche in order to actually do it. And then when I did, this, I don't know, sudden influx of creative energy overtook me. And I had the idea for my first book, The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a, I don't know if I can say that.
We
on your
have
podcast.
To say it on the plane.
Okay.
We can't have this chat without saying it.
Okay. I do a lot of radio and TV and it's always a little bit different. But yes, The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck was my first book. And around the time that I was writing it, my husband and I were also plotting to move out of Brooklyn and here to the Dominican Republic where we are now. So.
Where you just warned me right before we started recording that there's a fun party happening at the house next to you and your home doesn't really have walls. It sounds like, was it just open to the outdoor? Are you in a hut?
It has walls, but the windows are not particularly well sealed. They're just these like wooden slats. And yes, the guys who are renting the house next door seem to have decided to have an extremely loud lunch outside on their deck. So I haven't heard too much of it since we started talking. But.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So when you were editing books, which you did for 15 years, how many books do you think you edited?
Definitely over 100. I mean, I started as an assistant to a couple of, you know, really high profile editors at one company, and I rose through the ranks and started acquiring my own books. So I was working on books of theirs. I was working on books of mine. For the last 10 years of my career, I was totally autonomous, doing all of my own work. So yeah, I would put it at over 100.
Wow. And I mean, were most of them or some of them, a lot of them self-help books? Like, how did you come to write your own? Did you ever know when you were editing a self-help book that this is something you wanted to do?
Almost none of them were self-help books. In fact, I edited one book in the last few years called Promised Land, A Journey into America's Self-Help Culture by Jessica Lamb Shapiro that was actually a somewhat, I wouldn't call it negative, but it was a skeptical view of the self-help industry and all of the sort of gurus from the beginning of time until now. Really fascinating book for anybody who's interested in self-help, but definitely had more of the attitude of maybe this isn't all it's cracked up to be. And that was my attitude as well. So it is, again, sort of ironic that I
sort of, it's very ironic. Yeah. So you quit your job and you get all these creative juices. They just come over you. And then you just somehow just sit down and write this book, The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck? Like, how did that come to life?
Yeah, so it's obviously, well, I hope it's obvious, but probably your listeners have heard of the Japanese tidying guide by Marie Kondo called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up.
Uh-huh.
And in the summer of 2015, when I quit my job, that book was on the bestseller lists, and I read it. It was something that I had intended to read, and I just never had time for pleasure reading because I was always editing other people's books, and I liked it. I'm a very organized and tidy person, and I thought some of her tips and things were really relevant to my life, and I still use them today. But I also felt like the idea of tidying your physical space could expand to tidying your mental space. And I realized that sort of what I had been doing over the course of the last year as I was gearing up to quit my job and everything was really giving fewer fucks, or what I call in the book, I was spending fewer fuck bucks, my time, energy, and money on things that annoyed me. And Marie Kondo's big thing is hold on to what brings you joy. So the flip side of that is get rid of things that annoy. And I realized that I was doing that in my own life and that it was sort of ripe for a parody of her work. But I call it an affectionate parody. It's definitely, her book was a jumping off point, but then mine kind of turned into its own thing, which is really kind of amazing.
Wow. Does she ever communicate to you? Like, have you met? Does she know about your book? And
oh, I'm sure she knows about it. I mean, certainly her publishers know about it because you have to be really careful whenever you're publishing something that is along those lines of a parody that you're not infringing on anybody's space. But no, she and I have not communicated, although I would love to. I think, you know, there's actually very few people out there, no like big time critical reviewers, but some blog reviewers and people who post reviews on Goodreads that have actually read both of our books and written, you know, really interesting critical appraisals of how they are alike and how they are different. So I would find it fascinating to be on a panel or something with her.
That would be awesome. I mean, it should have happened. Like, it has to happen. It'll happen.
I think she's very busy.
Yes. Yes. Well, she has to read your book about how to organize her time better and get rid of, you know, clear up the mental space.
Perhaps. I mean, I'm pretty sure that over the course of the last couple of years, she had a baby. So that probably has taken a little bit of that time that I have myself without having kids. You know, I'm a lot more free and easy.
That's true. In the Dominican Republic too, chilling.
Yeah.
With the palm trees. So after the book came out, you did a TEDx talk called The Magic of Not Giving a Fuck, which has been viewed 3 million times now.
Yes, it's totally wild. I did not expect that.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I mean, I prepared for it as best I could. I spent, you know, they really give you almost a year from the time that they, from the time they reached out to me to ask if I wanted to do this. And it was at the TEDx Coconut Grove in Miami, Florida. So I had probably 10 months to really work on writing the talk and editing it and revising it and practicing it, and then working with the woman on their team who did the slides that were behind me, you know, on the stage, and really just getting everything completely memorized and then show up and do it. And suddenly in 12 minutes, that's it. You know, that's the 10 months of work that you put in are gone. And, you know, I knew that I had performed it the best that I was capable, and I felt really good about the content of the talk, but I had no inkling that it would go as incredibly viral as it did. It's really cool.
It's awesome. Was that ever, I mean, well, I guess considering you never really intended to write a book, the idea of giving a TEDx talk probably wasn't on your radar too, but that's, I mean, a major bucket list item.
Yeah. Looking back on it, I think I was in a little bit of like a fugue state while I was working on it because I was also writing my second book during the time that I was writing the TEDx talk based on my first book. And I was just really busy and just compartmentalizing, okay, today I have to do this, tomorrow I have to do that, you know. And so then looking back on everything, as you said earlier, this last sort of 2.5 years, it's really been a lot of things have been accomplished.
Amazing.
And, you know, with the third book out right now, it's sort of, it's time for me to actually take a page from my own work and do a little bit of relaxing, I think.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, your TED Talk, I understand why it went viral because it was brilliant. You know, it's essentially about—
Thank you.
Yeah, it's about looking at your time and your energy and your money, you know, which you call your fucks, and how you need to establish like a fuck budget and like a money budget and actually pick and choose what you give your fucks to, right? I mean, this is brilliant. How did this idea come to life?
Yeah, so I was just really trying to explain in a clear and entertaining and funny way how you can really have autonomy over your decision making and how you don't have to do things just because other people think you should do them, and you don't have to do things just because you always have done them. And that if you can identify the stuff that, as Marie Kondo would say, brings you joy, or as I would say, that annoys you, and hold on to the former and discard the latter, then you wind up with, you know, more time, energy, and money to spend on the things that really make you happy. And so in the parlance of the first book, you know, if I say I don't give a fuck about something, you understand that to mean I don't care about something. Mm-hmm. But I'm also saying now I will not give my fucks, my time, energy, and money, to that thing. So it's got kind of a double meaning. And I think it really just simplified what it means to say, I do not have the time, energy, or money to spend on this thing that is not rewarding to me.
And you mentioned visualization to help determine like what does and doesn't deserve your fucks. Like, how would a visualization work for such a thing?
So I use the example a lot of times of accepting or rejecting an invitation. You know, not every invitation is a demand that you show up to a place. It's right. An invite, and you're allowed to say no. But I think that a lot of people just say yes in the moment, and then they spend 3 weeks thinking, God, why did I say yes to that? I don't want to do it. I'm dreading it. You know, and then when they get to whatever the thing is, whether it's a wedding or just a colleague party or, you know, a book club that they didn't want to be part of, they really, you know, they have a terrible time and they feel like they've wasted their time, energy, and maybe their money. Mm. So I say, when the invitation comes, just spend, you know, a couple of minutes visualizing how you're going to feel at the event. And if you feel, oh God, why am I here? What have I done? I don't want to be hanging out with these people. I don't want to be doing this thing. Then say no. You know, you can save yourself a lot of heartache if you just are honest with yourself from the beginning and really put yourself in your own shoes. In the book, I use the example of waiting in line at the airport, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning on your way to Pittsburgh for your third cousin's wedding that you didn't want to go to.
That's so funny because all my cousins live in Pittsburgh.
Well, I promise that I did not know that before we had this phone call. I'm sure they're lovely people.
So, I mean, I do love how your philosophy is really all about honesty. I mean, really, all three of your books, that's like the bottom line. That's really the thread that runs through them. And being honest politely. Have you always been so honest like this, or so like, I don't give a fuck and I'm not afraid to tell you? Or have you had some sort of light bulb moment experience to sort of make you this way?
I think it's a little bit of the former and most of the latter. So I have definitely always been a very blunt person and very much questioning, well, why do we have to do things that way? You know, what if I don't want to do things that way? And that has always been an attitude I've had since I was a little kid. But it took until the last, you know, 3 years or so in my late 30s for me to realize that, A, it's okay to be that way. I don't have to hide that part of myself or feel bad about that part of myself. And B, how to be that way without, as I say in the book, becoming an asshole.
Yeah. How do you become that way without becoming an asshole?
Well, it's so in the book, I call it the not sorry method. And basically, you know, there's two steps. You decide what you don't give a fuck about, and then you stop giving a fuck about those things. But if you do it with a mix of honesty and politeness, then you have nothing to feel guilty about and you are not sorry. So what I try to explain to people is, if somebody invites you to a party that you don't want to go to, first of all, be honest and say, no, thank you, I can't make it, you know, which sort of means I don't want to make it, but no, thank you, I can't make it. Right away. Don't hem and haw and wait until the last minute and then say no. These people are trying to organize a party. Don't be that guy. And also don't say yes to something you don't want to do and then cancel at the last minute, because that's also rude.
Classic.
You know, so you really have to be honest with yourself and other people, and then you have to be polite about it. And there's a sliding scale. You know, you don't say to your friend, no thanks, I can't make it to your dinner party because I hate the guy you're dating and I don't want to have to talk to him for 3 hours. That's too far
right.
on the honest scale and not far enough on the polite scale. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I just try to keep those two things in mind whenever I'm responding or deciding what I do or don't want to do, and, you know, communicating that decision to other people.
Makes so much sense. I mean, there is such a scale of, like you said, you know, telling somebody I don't want to come for XYZ reason versus just like, sorry, I can't. I mean, those are two different experiences. So, I mean, I would imagine that living this way, in this way being just like your method, or, you know, your like no fucks giving way of life, I would imagine that this takes a lot of stress out of your life. Have you noticed that your stress levels have, you know, gone to a healthier place? Like, have there been any physical changes that you've noticed since you've stopped giving a fuck?
Absolutely. I mean, just in the sense that I stopped giving a fuck about my corporate job. And by that, I mean, you know, I stopped commuting an hour and a half every day. I stopped wearing uncomfortable high heels and clothes that didn't make me feel comfortable. I stopped interacting with a lot of people on a daily basis that I didn't really want to interact with. All of those things were drains on my time, energy, and money, you know, and just on the money front, not having a New York City monthly Metro card, because, you know how much those are. What are they, like $150 at this point?
Yeah.
Because I didn't have to commute twice a day anymore. I mean, that's huge. So there's all of these little things that combine to one giant deficit of stress, mm-hmm. Which I have certainly noticed and been incredibly grateful for over the last 2.5 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of stress, I found it so interesting and then kind of obvious, but in your second book, Get Your Shit Together, you write that you got a lot of fan mail from people saying that they actually aspire to have and to do less, not more, which is different from, I guess, traditional self-helpy stuff where it's all about like, go out there and like get your dream home, get your dream bod, get your dream partner. It's interesting that people are writing to you saying that they desire to get less, you know, to do less. So I love that you developed the idea that you call the power of negative thinking.
That's right. It's a very popular method from the second book. But yeah, I mean, I am a person who is motivated more by negativity than positivity. And that is reflected in the first book when I say, identify the things that annoy you and get rid of them. I also think it's reflected in the second book, Get Your Shit Together, is really all about setting goals and achieving them. And it can be any goal. It can be a goal to have more, or it can be a goal to have less. But take what's wrong with your life and confront it and accept those negative feelings and say, I don't want to feel this way anymore, rather than kind of chasing after these aspirational, well, if I were 20 pounds thinner, I would be happy. Look at yourself now and say, I'm really unhappy that I am 20 pounds overweight. And I use weight as an example because it's a really easy thing for people to understand.
Yeah.
But I also want to be really clear that in all of my books, I am very body positive and talk quite a bit about how I no longer give a fuck about having a perfect body. And that, you know, if that's your goal, great. But if it's not your goal, then use that time, energy, and money to pursue other things.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because that, you know, you write a lot about body image stuff. And I've been talking a ton about body image stuff lately because I'm getting married in under a year. And I made a public announcement, well, to my podcast listeners, but that I'm not actively like shedding for the wedding. And so, you know, we're very body positive over here. And so one of my favorite chapters in, or I don't know, or sections, what do you call them in your book? Because they're not like numbered. They're not like chapters. One. Okay.
Yeah, that's
chapters. I don't know. It's great. But one of my favorite in your third book, your newest book, You Do You, is called You Shouldn't Eat That, asterisks, I'll take extra cheese, please. Which is where you really share your long, you know, abusive, as you call it, relationship with your body. So I'd be really curious if you wouldn't mind sharing your story with eating disorders and body image issues.
Yeah, it's really something that I think a lot of people experience and maybe not enough people talk about. So I'm always happy to put my story into words and writing in hopes that somebody will recognize themselves and say, oh, maybe I could, you know, stop being this way. So yeah. Basically, when I was about 13, I started dieting. And that was after a childhood of, you know, just being standard, you know, chubby kid who was probably made fun of a little bit more than other kids for her weight, as opposed to being made fun of for other things. And for whatever reason, those, you know, comments stuck with me. And I wanted really badly to lose weight, and I started doing it. And because I'm a type A control freak, once I started doing it, I couldn't stop because it was like, oh, you know, every pound less was a victory and was, you know, me being in control of my body that I had never really been in control of before. So by the time I was probably a year into that, I was full-blown anorexic. I was eating like 2 wedges of orange every day.
Oh my God.
Became very expert at moving food around on my plate so that my parents didn't really realize what I was and wasn't eating. And then I graduated from that lifestyle to being bulimic, because once I broke my fast, I then started eating everything in sight. But of course, I didn't want to gain the weight back, yeah. So I started throwing it up. And, you know, I think it's, again, a pretty classic cycle for a lot of young women, young people, perhaps, but definitely young women. And it really took me until my mid-20s to completely divest myself of the urge to either starve myself or to purge, you know, to binge and purge. And then it took another, I would say, a good 10 years to my mid-30s to come to the realization and the acceptance of, this is what I look like. This is the size and shape that I was born into. There's nothing wrong with it. And it's much healthier and better for me just on a daily basis in terms of being a happy person to not worry about it anymore. And in You Do You, which is my third book that you were mentioning, it's really, that whole book is about self-acceptance and confidence. And accepting yourself for who you are, flaws and all, whether they're self-identified flaws or flaws that other people say you have, but you don't actually agree that they're flaws. And presenting yourself to the world, you know, as exactly as you are, and not trying to be somebody else and not trying to meet expectations and fulfill obligations put on you by other people. And that could be a specific person, or it could just sort of be society as a whole. So it really is, and I say this in the book, and I haven't been called out on it yet, but the book's only been out for 2 weeks, so we'll see if anybody argues with me. But, you know, I do say that for me, it really has been mind over matter. And my first two books are all about what I call mental decluttering, and You Do You, I have a technique called mental redecorating. And it really, it's actually neuroplasticity. I mean, it's actual scientific methods, but for me, it's just, you know, thinking a different way about myself. And if you do that enough, you will eventually feel a different way about yourself. And that's, you know, I think, again, I'm just trying to simplify ideas for people to say, hey, this is what worked for me, and maybe it'll work for you too.
So the mental redecorating, I love that. It's so funny. is what, how you would say you really did come to that place of body acceptance and confidence after those, you know, for those 10 years of struggling, when once you stopped doing the eating disorder behavior, but then you had to get your mind on right. And that was really the mental redecorating.
Exactly. So one of the examples I use in the book is, you know, if you have these comments that people have said about you, and I can remember several of them that I talk about in the book very clearly from when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Those are like unflattering photos, and you would never mount and frame and hang an unflattering photo of yourself in your house because it makes you feel bad.
Right.
So instead, I said, all right, I'm not going to think about these things anymore. I'm going to take these photos. I can't erase the fact that they exist. They were taken, but I can put them in a box at the back of my mental closet, and I can instead mount and frame and hang all of the nice things that people have said about me. So, you know, in the book, I give the example of, wow, you have such a great way with eye makeup.
I know. I laughed out loud.
Like, just learn to take a fucking compliment and then refer to those compliments mentally when you're feeling like, you know, you need a little bit of a pick-me-up. So it's a, you know, potentially somebody might look at that and say, well, that's kind of a silly way to think about it, and body image is a much more serious thing. But for me, it's not. For me, it's a very simple binary. You either feel good about yourself or you don't.
Yeah.
So if you don't, look at why you don't feel good about yourself. Oh, because people are saying mean things about you. Okay, stop thinking about the mean things that people are saying about you and focus on the nice things that people are saying about you. And the way, you know, that the metaphor works in the book is like, you don't perhaps have the time or energy or wherewithal or desire to renovate your entire house, but you can make a significant improvement by just, you know, rearranging stuff that's already there. and, you know, refreshing the way you look at or deal with things in the same way that you might refresh a room in your house to make it more inviting. You know, take the couch, and instead of having it face the TV, you have it face a coffee table with two other chairs, and you've created the space where people can talk and hang out instead of just zoning out to the TV. So there are ways to take what's already in your mind and the things that you already are experiencing on a daily basis and just realign them so that they're working with you, not against you.
I love it. I mean, you have a line, I'm forgetting it. I'm sure you remember. It's something like funny with feng shui in it. It's like,
right. It's feng shui with a side of fuck that shit.
How do you come up with this? Like, you're so funny. Like, were you a humor writer when you were like, where did this come from? Because I mean, we'll go back to the emotional stuff, but like, I just have to know you're so funny and clever. And I'm laughing my ass off through every page of your book. I'm laughing out loud. Like, how do you do this?
Well, that really makes me happy because it's the primary thing that I want to do with my books is be funny. Like, that's really my goal. And the self-help stuff is the secondary goal, which probably my publisher doesn't want me to tell people, but it is. And I don't know. I think my dad's side of the family in particular are all performers, you know, very funny, wisecracking. Everybody's trying to one-up everybody. I think for people like my husband to come into that group, it took a few years for him to realize that that's just how we are. But I think that definitely comes through on the page. And, you know, and I try really hard also to make the humor in my books relatable and to make sure that there's something in there for everyone. So, you know, sometimes I get little angry tweets every once in a while from people because I make a joke about vegans or I make a joke about being gluten-free. But I always tell them there's jokes about all kinds of people in the books. And if you just keep reading, then I'm sure you're going to laugh about something that somebody else would find a little bit offensive. It's all, you know, it's all meant to be in good fun.
But it's so fun. I mean, there's Friends references. There's a chapter or a section, Let It Out, like Elsa or whatever, that from that thing. There's Mario Kart metaphors. I mean, it's next level. Like, it is one of the most creative piece of writing, all your books. It's just so,
well, thank you.
It's amazing. I mean, I don't know how you do it. And you banged out 3 books in such a short amount of time, and each of them are just freaking hilarious.
Well, thank you. That really, it really, really, really makes me happy to hear that. And I think, you know, for anybody who is trying to do the same thing, trying to create anything, you know, whether it's a book or some other piece of art or accomplish any goal, the second book, Get Your Shit Together, is really all about how I did it. It's not hard. It's just planning, you know. Oh. It's just, okay, I need to write 40,000 words. How many words a day is that before the deadline? 800. Okay. Butt in the seat, 800 words. Don't do anything else until you've done that kind of stuff. So again, as I said before, when I look back on it, I think, whoa, I basically wrote and published and promoted 3 books in 2 years. And I'm not sure how I did it either. And then I go back and I think, oh, I know exactly how I did it. Planned it out.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I reached out to you for a chat, you were in the middle of writing your now 3rd book. And you were like, right, I can't do anything now until the book is done. But, you know, reach out to me later. And I really was like, wow, like, she's got her shit together.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of what I said in all of the books, but going back to the life-changing magic of not giving a fuck, is about setting boundaries and saying no. And that's okay. And so for me, especially as the books have gone out into the world, and because they're published all over the world, I have not only, you know, publicity and interview requests from the US, but from Canada and the UK and Australia and New Zealand and Poland and France and Italy and all of these places. So it's a lot to juggle. And I have to be able to say, I can't do anything else for the next, you know, 3 weeks because I'm writing this book. Or, you know, I know I have 3 podcasts already scheduled in one day. And I know for my own like mental energy that I can't schedule a 4th one. So I have to start saying no for a particular date. And it's really very easy once you start doing it. I think a lot of people don't realize how easy it is to say no. And then they don't even try. But once you try and the world doesn't end, then it gets easier and easier every time.
Well, it's about having the confidence to say no, like, and realize the world's not going to end and people aren't going to hate you and it's going to be fine. And, you know, a major point that you hit home in your book, You Do You, is why it's so very important to like actually be selfish. And I love how you remind us that there's actually a spectrum of selfishness and that there's good selfish and bad selfish. So can you define like what good selfish is for everybody listening?
Yeah. So I think of good selfish as self-care, as making a decision that is benefiting you more than it's hurting anybody else, or not hurting anybody else at all, which is really the lowest part of the selfish spectrum. The best part is when it's not hurting anybody else. But sometimes, you know, for example, again, turning down an invitation, you know, yes, maybe my friend will be, you know, slightly disappointed that I can't be at her party. But if I would be more disappointed by being at that party, then I don't think that it's a bad thing to preserve my time and energy and say, no, I can't make it that night for whatever reason. But I use a lot of different examples in the book, you know, about, for example, if you really need to get 8 hours of sleep and it's really important to you and you want to be kind of selfish about it with regard to your spouse or your kids, and you say, I just need my 8 hours. I'm going to bed at 11. You know, nobody talked to me until 7 a.m. That's okay. That's good selfish. If you fall asleep on the couch and expect them all to tiptoe around you for 8 hours, that's bad selfish.
Right.
Like, you know, there's definitely a scale of not only a decision that is selfish that is okay to make, but also how you go about enacting that decision, which also goes back to the honesty and politeness of the first book. And yeah, I devote an entire chapter in You Do You to being selfish because I think it's the thing that the most people, either, you know, people who write me fan mail or people that I talk to on the radio or podcasts, have a hard time with about the books. They're like, I just can't quite do that. I just don't feel comfortable being that selfish. And so I really wanted to spend like a big chunk of time in the new book saying, yes, you can. Here's how to do it. Here's why it's okay. And so, as you know, because you read the book, I came up with another way to say it, which is that you're being selfish, which is sort of right in the middle
of
good and bad.
Ah, amazing. But I do love that like selfish is really just a fun way of saying self-care, like you said. I mean,
yeah.
And I love the Gwyneth Paltrow jab in that part. I laughed out loud. So funny. But I mean, that's all it really is. It's prioritizing yourself in a way that doesn't necessarily like mean up taking a bath. You know, it's like, so for you, I guess I'm wondering, what are some selfish things that you do that have helped you, you know, be your best self?
Well, for example, and I know that a lot of people will think that this is silly and think, oh my God, I can't believe that she cares so much, but I hate getting up early.
Oh my God, I can't believe she cares so much.
I don't get up early. I'm not, you know, I did it for 15 years in my corporate world. I did it when I was, you know, had to get up and go to classes in college. I did it for, you know, 12 years going to school as a little kid, and I just hate it. And it makes me unhappy and it makes me stressed out. And I don't function very well. So in my new life, I really schedule things around not having to get up early. And, you know, if that means that I'm not going to get to your beach barbecue until 1 p.m. instead of 10 a.m., then I do me.
I love it. I love it. That's good. So, I mean, that's just so simple. And it's a shame that there are people that would get there at 10 a.m. just to not disappoint other people. I think we all do need to just be a little bit more selfish. And I think in turn, we're going to be better people to be around too. Like you'll be more pleasant if you get there and you don't have to rush and wake up super early, even though that's prioritizing your needs, versus if you had to wake up and you were grumpy and you got there and you were a little resentful and then you left early and blah, 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 blah. Like that's not good for anybody.
Exactly. And I also make the further point that do you want somebody to be somewhere doing something for you that you know they don't want to be doing? And if that's the case, then maybe you're the asshole in the situation, not the person who said, sorry, I can't make it. And I think that's a really important thing to remember because as I try to say in all of my books, I'm not telling you what to do and how to do it and that this is the only way. I'm telling you that it's okay to arrange your life in the way that is best for you, whatever that way may be, but especially in You Do You, I come to the conclusion that you have to let other people do them too. Mm. And so really putting yourself every once in a while on the other side of the conversation or the situation or the event or the scenario is a good way to remember, oh, that person is out there trying to live their best life too. I can accept that and respect that and let them do what they want. And if that means that you're letting your friend Sarah not get up at 8 o'clock in the morning to come to your baby shower on Sunday, then that really shouldn't be a problem. If you're really good friends, you'll understand what each other needs out of life.
Yeah. So you do you, they do they.
Yep.
New subtitle. I mean, I feel like similar to Marie Kondo's method, which is, you know, the biggest thing, I read her book and the biggest thing I took away from it was to like hold up your physical items and see and feel if it sparks joy. I do feel like your method and philosophy is also about doing things that bring you joy, or I guess eliminating the things that annoy. Mm-hmm. And you write, you know, if people want to, you say, you write, go ahead and do your whole 30 cleanse and your side planks. If that makes you happy, you do you. And I appreciate that because there are people, you know, going back to the body image stuff, there are people that actually enjoy, like myself, doing my side planks and eating really mm-hmm. well. And that's, you know, but I don't think, and I think you would agree that the worst thing to do is to force yourself to do things that you don't want to do, that don't bring you joy.
Exactly. And, you know, when I was younger and I was going through all of the issues with various, you know, eating disorders and things, I was also exercising like a fiend. I was pushing myself to run 6 miles every day. And if you know me, you know that I hate physical activity. I hate exercise. I'm deeply uncoordinated. You know, the idea of running for an hour a day is just madness. But I was doing it because I just thought I had to do it to be skinnier. I thought I just was so focused on this idea of being thin that I did all of these things that I hated. Mm-hmm. And I ate things I hated and I didn't eat things that I loved. And I did all this exercise that really did not make me happy. Whereas for somebody else, you know, I have some friends who suffer from depression and anxiety for whom exercise is the number one cure.
Yeah, I'm one of those friends.
It's the thing that makes them the happiest that they'll ever be. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, in my books, I'm not trying to say you have to do things. Basically, like, you don't necessarily have to do the things I do. This is just how I make the decisions to do what I want to do. And you can make those same decisions for your life and apply it to whatever makes you happy.
But what about things that like one quote unquote ought to do? Like we all know, you know, you're on the Party of My Plants podcast. We all know that one ought to eat their fruits and vegetables to be a healthier person, or one ought to get some exercise or some form of movement in for their longevity. So if you personally like hate movement, do you still somehow find movement in your life in a way that brings you joy? Like, how do you kind of do things that like you should do, but, you know, aren't like your number one choice of activity?
Well, specifically to the first question, yes. And what I do is I walk on the beach.
Perfect.
And doesn't feel like exercise. I'm not doing it to raise my heart rate. I'm doing it because I love looking at the ocean and being in the sun and having an hour a day to just talk to my husband about whatever is going on, whatever we need to do. We've got guests coming. Who's going to clean this? Who's going to clean that? But you're doing it in this beautiful sort of natural splendor that to me is the goal to me is get outside and look at the water. And the, you know, the byproduct of that is that I've just walked for an hour on the beach, which is good for me. And I understand that it's good for me, but I've found a way to do that, you know, also doesn't annoy me.
Yeah.
And the second part of it is really the middle book, Get Your Shit Together, deals with the stuff that you have to do. So if physical decluttering is about, you know, discarding things that don't bring you joy and organizing what you have left, then mental decluttering is about discarding the things on which you no longer want to spend your fucks, and then organizing what you have left, your time, energy, and money, and deploying it efficiently on the things that you want to do and on the goals that you want to achieve. But some things we all know you do have to give a fuck about. Mm-hmm. There are just some non-negotiable fucks that need to be given in life. And Get Your Shit Together helps you accomplish those in the most efficient way possible so that you, you know, are saving as much of your time, energy, and money as you can for the stuff that you really want to do. But it helps you finish and, you know, and prioritize and really just kind of knock out the stuff on the to-do list that you really have no choice but to do. Like go to work, you know, you have to go to work because you have to make money because you have to pay your rent. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you have to go to work, here's how you can get your job done faster.
Ooh. Kind of stuff. Yeah. So mental decluttering, how would you define mental decluttering?
So it's really, it's just that simple of discarding and then organizing. So I take people through an exercise in the life-changing magic of not giving a fun, excuse me, giving a fuck.
I like fun.
About, you know, imagine your mind as a barn and it's just full of all of this clutter and you go in there and you sit down and you write down every, you know, you basically inventory your mental barn, all of the fucks that you're being asked to give on a daily basis. And you break it down into categories so that it's not quite so overwhelming. But, you know, for example, work is one of the categories and, you know, write everything down and then look at your list. And when and say, do I really give a fuck about that? And if the answer is no, cross it off.
Like holding up a shirt and saying, does it spark joy? No.
Exactly.
Donating.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's just you and a few pieces of paper and a big black marker. And it's very liberating. And then once you've done that, once you've discarded those fucks that you no longer want to give, then you can organize what you have left. You know, then you can make your mental space just as, you know, airy and bright as Marie Kondo would make your physical space.
Right. That's great. And so that's your first two books are really about mental decluttering. And then the most recent book, You Do mm-hmm. You, is mental redecorating, which is really about changing your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, what I say in You Do You is that, first of all, there's nothing wrong with you.
Thank you.
And the whole book is really about you coming to realize and accept that. And so the book is not about changing who you are. The book is about changing how you feel about who you are and changing how you deal with other people and their opinions about who you are. Mm. So, you know, a lot of, I think, self-help books are necessarily and perfectly legitimately about changing you, about changing your body or changing your style or changing, you know, your personality. And this one is not. This is about accepting who you are and then just changing how you feel about it, no longer being made to feel like there's something wrong with you. So I think it's definitely, to me, the most profound of the three books. I hope that it's as funny as the other two.
I laughed out loud a ton.
I'm glad. But I do think that it's a message that it took me, you know, 30 plus years to figure out and internalize. So I'm hoping that it'll reach some other people well before that and give them, you know, a few more years of acceptance and confidence than I had.
Yeah. Well, confidence, that was one thing I wanted to ask you about. I mean, I think the mission, the underlying mission of all your books, especially You Do You, is about instilling confidence in people or helping people feel so much more confident. Have you gotten letters and, you know, response from readers that like this book is really helping them with their confidence? Do you think that not giving as many fucks and, you know, doing all the stuff, is this all about confidence to you the same way as like I'm reading it and I'm like, oh, this is about confidence?
Yeah. I mean, I get fan mail every day from people all over the world and mostly they say that they feel liberated, that they didn't know it was possible to feel so good about themselves, which is another way of saying to feel so confident.
Yeah.
And that makes me really happy because, you know, there's so many different kinds of people in the world and there's so many different ways to live your life. And, you know, I have happened upon some ways that are working out really well for me. So if it's possible to translate those to other people and, you know, improve their lives while I'm at it over here writing profanity-laced humor books, then, you know, the more the merrier.
That's awesome. Did you know this was going to be a trilogy from the get-go?
No, I definitely didn't. Partly because I, as a book editor, I was so used to, you know, publishing a really great book and then having it go nowhere and not really sell any copies and nobody ever heard of it. And, you know, there it went. So as a writer, I wasn't sort of looking toward a series because I didn't know yet if the first one would work. So I think part of it is like just the natural jadedness of a book industry professional.
Wow. That's fascinating. And so you wrote all three. Is there more? Or is this the last one?
I believe that there will be more.
Oh my goodness. That's awesome.
You Do You just came out on November 21st, and I have had some conversations with my various publishers about what they might like to see next and what I might like to do next. But I'm also just trying to take a little bit of time to sit under my palm trees and drink my Aperol spritzes and enjoy the holidays and then kind of get right back to it in January.
I mean, I can't believe you wrote so many so fast. How did You Do You come to be? I mean, was it just... did you pull from the first or second book and, you know, pull like one idea and expand upon it? Or, I mean, I didn't read them all in sequence. I've just kind of like read them different chunks at different times. But like, do you feel like it's 1, 2, 3 or is one book more important than the other? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that I wrote them very specifically so that they could be read as standalone books. There's a lot of people out there who've read Get Your Shit Together and haven't read either of the other two, you know, and there's a lot of people who are coming to You Do You as the first book and then hopefully saying, oh, I really like her. I'm going to go back and read the first two. So I definitely tried really hard to make sure that each of them stood alone and didn't rely on concepts that you would have to know from the other books. Like sometimes I've re-explained a few things here and there in case somebody hasn't read them. But I also didn't want them to be super repetitive. I would say that the first two are pretty clear, like, you know, Get Your Shit Together is a very clear sequel to the first book. And You Do You is more like a step beyond. Those first two books are really method heavy. They're really about, you know, okay, step one, do this, step two, do that. Here's a trick for doing this. Here's a trick for doing that. And they're really more about, like I said, organizing your mental clutter and decluttering your mind. And You Do You is a lot more personal stories. It's a lot more narrative driven. And it's really encompasses this idea that I've always had and that I've been getting more and more excited about over the last couple of years of like, you know what? I don't have to do things the way everybody says. I talk about the tyranny of just because. You know, just because that's how other people do it doesn't mean I have to do it. And frankly, the success of the first two books really allowed me to pitch You Do You to my publishers and say, you know, it's still a no fucks given guide. It still has a lot of practical advice in it, but it's, I think, a little bit more unconventional. You know, if you look at Get Your Shit Together, that's a pretty standard, you know, method for organizing your life. I mean, it's told in funny language and it's got profanity, you know, and it has all these fun little methods and stuff, but it's really standard advice. You know, this is how to set a goal and this is how to achieve it. Whereas You Do You, I think, is more, I think, sort of more revelatory. Like, hey guys, guess what? There's nothing wrong with you.
I love it. Like,
you don't get that from a lot of self-help books. And building all of the different stories from my life and all of the examples and stuff around it was a much different writing process than the first two books.
I feel like even as you're speaking of it, your heart is just so much in this most recent book. I mean, I feel like, I don't know, I just get that vibe that you're just very emotionally connected to it and that you just want to, kind of the self-help guru, not anti-guru, the self-help guru in you is kind of coming out.
Yeah. I think so. I'm pretty attached to this one. So I'm looking forward to seeing how it does and how it's received, you know, and that will also kind of inform whatever I do next. If I feel like I can keep going in this direction or maybe do something even more different, we shall see.
We shall see. Well, okay. A few final personal questions about you before I let you go, because you're on the Party My Plants podcast. We got some planty questions for you. Do you have a favorite plants-based restaurant? It doesn't be like vegan, just like where you get a very good plant dish.
Okay. Well, it's hard because I've left behind the restaurants in New York that I was, you know, going to for years and years. And I actually, my husband does all of our cooking here now. So my favorite plant-based foods are actually the ones he makes for me.
Yeah, I read that he's like a crazy, amazing, obsessive gourmet chef.
Yeah, it's really, awesome. I love his roasted eggplant. He made me homemade hummus. My birthday was the other day and he made me homemade hummus because we can't get it at any of the grocery stores here in the Dominican Republic.
You can't get hummus?
No, it's really weird. It's just like a thing they don't have. So that's really, you know, that's kind of what I would say is that I just eat all of the vegetables that my husband cooks for me.
Well, lucky girl.
I am very lucky.
So what is his or your most used kitchen tool?
I think that his most used kitchen tool is probably his trusty all-around chef's knife cleaver thing. This like very expensive knife that was transported down here in our luggage.
Oh my god.
That he can't live without. And my most used kitchen tool is definitely the coffee machine.
I thought you were going to say a fork. So coffee machine. That's awesome. So what is your favorite plant to eat?
My favorite plant to eat. Well, I was in New York a few weeks ago for my father-in-law's birthday, and they took us out to this amazing restaurant called Blue Hill at Stone Barns.
Oh, wow.
And
that's nice.
They do like a 20-course tasting menu, and it's all from the farm. And of course, some of it is meat because they're a farm, but a lot of it is vegetables. And there was this mushroom tart that they made you forage for your tart. Like they put them out on plates that were covered in leaves and stuff.
What?
And so you had to like actually pick the leaves aside with your hands and find your, you know, your tart. And I ate it and it was so good. And it reminded me like how much I love mushrooms and how very different they are depending, like you can get hen of the woods that are like these crunchy, like savory, delicious. And then you can have the portobellos that are like spongy and meaty. So then I promptly asked my husband to start cooking with more mushrooms.
There you
when
go.
We got back here. So I would say mushrooms.
Do you have
it was a very
mushrooms?
Long,
no, it was
long-winded
very descriptive.
Way.
Beautiful, beautiful. You painted that story.
No, he can get them. There's all kinds of, there's like a grocery store and then there's sort of all these little like huts and stuff where he buys herbs and different produce. And it's kind of like a day-long thing when he goes grocery shopping because he has to go to like five different places to get everything that he wants.
But he loves it, sounds
but
like.
But no hummus.
No hummus. So. Weird. Well, making your own is better anyway.
It's pretty delicious.
Yeah, that's awesome. So is there a book that's inspired you in some awesome way?
Well, I certainly think that Marie Kondo's book inspired me. I mean, not only did she give voice to my own natural tendencies to be really decluttered and tidy and organized, she also gave me some actual really practical tips on how to keep my space, you know, as decluttered as possible. But she gave me the greatest inspiration of all, which was to go out and write my own book. So I would have to give her proper credit.
That's really nice. That's fair. Good one. Good choice. So where can everyone go besides their local bookstore or their favorite online bookstore to follow what you're up to?
My website is sarahknightauthor.com. And that has all of the most up-to-date information on all of my books and all of the links on where to buy them. You can also follow me on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Medium. At MC Snugs. That's MCSNUGZ. And I'm very active on all of those platforms. And I have a tiny letter. It's my No Fucks Given newsletter. So you can go to tinyletter.com/Sarah Knight and you can sign up there. And there's also a sign up button on my website.
What does MC Snugs mean?
Well, it's a silly story, but my husband and I used to have this terrible cat who passed away a couple of years ago, and his name was Doug. And we had a lot of nicknames for Doug, and we decided that his rap name was MC Snugs. So when I originally got on Twitter, you really can't have – my name is just so common, and there's really, like, nothing that I could have that was a variation of Sarah Knight. So I just decided to go completely in the other direction, and MC Snugs just became my online presence, and now – you know, many, 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 many thousands of followers later,
oh
I feel
God.
Like I can't change it. So.
That is so funny. You're stuck with it. Well, you're honoring Doug in a very nice way.
Every day.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us and for putting such bomb books out into the world. Really so inspiring, so funny, so awesome.
Well, thank you again for having me and for all of your kind words. It's really nice to connect with people who have read the books and have gotten something out of them, and also who get my, like, child of the 90s references.
So yes, so also. Many references. So good. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. Whoa, what a whammy of a chat. Am I right? I don't know about you, but I am adopting Sarah's not sorry method right now, starting with going out for dinner, because honestly, I don't feel like cooking tonight. And sorry, not sorry about that wallet. Sorry, not sorry. If only I had budgeted my fucks better today, I'd have the time and energy and desire to cook some healthy grub tonight. So tomorrow, better fuck budgeting begins. For a full list of definitions of all these humorous and helpful terms from our chat, plus Sarah's epic TEDx talk, plus so much other stuff that takes the hell out of being a healthy and happy human, head to partyinmyplants.com/70.